As Dr. Butler said, my name is Caitlin Cooper, and today I will be talking about the effect of drought on browse from three oak species. So let's start out with a little background information. Global climate change leads to frequent extreme weather events, including severe drought. And current climate models predict that the frequency, duration, and intensity of drought events is only going to increase in the future. And as you can see from the bottom right picture, in the year 2011, drought was particularly bad in the state of Texas. This drought resulted in the death of over 301 million trees in the state of Texas alone. And among those trees that were affected were various native oak species, especially in the drier, more western regions of the state. And this has negative impacts to both wildlife and livestock that utilize these species for browse. Drought-induced mortality is thought to occur through two primary mechanisms: carbon starvation, and hydraulic failure. And it's likely a combination of these two that will ultimately kill a tree. The carbon starvation hypothesis says that prolonged stomatal closure, in order to prevent water loss to the atmosphere, results in a lack of intake of CO2 and the inhibition of photosynthesis. So if photosynthesis decreases to a great degree, but the plant keeps a high carbon demand, it will have to start turning to its carbon reserves for metabolism. And if these carbon stores cannot meet the plant demands, carbon will become limiting. If drought perseveres, all the plant's carbon reserves could be depleted, which could result in mortality from carbon starvation. Hydraulic failure occurs when plants do not close their stomata in order to prevent water loss, and they have inadequate control of this water loss, which will result in cavitation and embolism. And embolized conduits can be refilled to a certain extent, but this is limited during drought because there's a lack of water to refill those conduits, and it's an energy-expensive process that uses carbohydrates that could be limited at this time due to decreased photosynthesis. So we see that there is this interaction between carbon limitation and hydraulic failure feeding upon each other. And as the number of embolized conduits that can't be refilled increases, photosynthesis is going to decrease even further due to reduced hydraulic conductivity. But early on in the drought, non-fatal physiological responses may include reductions in photosynthesis, growth, carbohydrate concentrations, and chemical defenses, including condensed tannins. The condensed tannins that I will be referring to in this presentation are those that bind protein, or protein precipitable phenolics, PPP for short. So with that in mind, this study was designed to evaluate the physiological responses of oak species to summer drought using rainfall manipulation. The three species that we included in the study were bur oak, live oak, and Schumard oak. Throughout this presentation, I'll be using the acronyms BO for bur oak, LO for live oak, and SO for Schumard oak. Three-year-old saplings of these three species were grown under rainout shelters, like the ones that you see in the bottom left-hand picture, in College Station, Texas. In June 2014, these shelters were divided into two treatments: watered, receiving the equivalent of normal precipitation, and droughted, receiving no water. We took measurements on an approximately monthly basis between June and October of 2014. Those measurements included leaf water potential, which was measured with a Scholander-type pressure chamber that you can see in the bottom left-hand picture. This was measured pre-dawn between 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock in the morning. And we know that leaf water potential will become more negative as water stress increases. We also measured photosynthesis using a Licor 6400 infrared gas analyzer system that you can see in the bottom middle and right pictures. And we know that there is a correlation between leaf water potential and photosynthesis. As the leaf water potential becomes more negative and the plant is more stressed, at some point the plant will reach this threshold where they stop conducting photosynthesis, as you can see in that figure to the right. And this varies by species. Following our leaf water potential and photosynthesis measurements, we collected leaves every month for laboratory analyses, including soluble sugar concentration and protein precipitable phenolic concentration analyses. We also took height measurements at the beginning and the end of the growing season. And while we were conducting those other measurements, we also took or measured the volumetric water content of the top 30 centimeters of the soil in our plots. On this graph, you can see that I have the volumetric water content averaged for the droughted and the watered plots and the measurement dates. And as you can see, volumetric water content differences between the droughted and the watered plots were greatest around day 60. So we expected to see peak treatment differences in physiology at this time. And with that in mind, and in the interest of time, the following results, except for our height growth, were from measurements taken at day 60. The experiment was set up as a split plot design with the shelters as replications, the watering treatment as the main plot, species as the subplot. Data were analyzed using the GLIMIX procedure of SAS, and differences were considered significant at p equal to or less than 0.05. And mean separations were carried out for the treatment by species interactions for all variables. So let's get into the results. I'd like to point out that for each of these graphs, the three species will be across the x-axis. The white bars will represent the droughted saplings, and the gray bars will represent the watered saplings. So figure one shows the pre-dawn leaf water potential. And not surprisingly, the leaf water potential was more negative in the droughted saplings than the watered saplings within each of the species. But leaf water potential did not differ between the species within their respective treatments, which tells us that all of the species were experiencing similar water stress in the droughted treatment at this time. Figure two shows our photosynthesis rates. And not surprising again, the watered saplings had greater photosynthesis rates than the droughted saplings within each species. But we do see that the available water had a different effect across species for this response variable. The watered live oak exhibited the greatest photosynthesis rates, and the droughted live oak actually had photosynthesis rates that were similar to those of the watered Schumard oak. Live oak had the greatest carbon assimilation rates within both treatments, and bur oak and Schumard oak had similar carbon assimilation rates. So where is this carbon going? Figure 3A shows height growth, 3B soluble sugar concentration, and 3C protein precipitable phenolic concentration. If you remember, the live oak should accumulate the greatest amounts of carbon through photosynthesis. And indeed, those watered live oak saplings that had the greatest photosynthesis rates also had the greatest height growth. But there were no differences between the droughted saplings of the three species. And live oak only had intermediate soluble sugar and protein precipitable phenolic concentrations. The bur oak and the Schumard oak had similar photosynthesis rates and should assimilate similar amounts of carbon, but the carbon allocation patterns differ between these two species. The bur oak grew taller than the Schumard oak within the water treatment, but not the droughted treatment. And bur oak had the lowest soluble sugar, but greatest protein precipitable phenolic concentrations, while the Schumard oak was the exact opposite, having the greatest soluble sugar concentrations and lowest protein precipitable phenolic concentrations, which suggests that bur oak allocates more of its carbon to growth and chemical defenses, while Schumard oak allocates more of its carbon to simple soluble sugars that it retains in the leaves rather than mobilizing them to other parts of the tissue for growth or taking that carbon and putting it into more complex, higher molecular weight carbon compounds like PPP. So in conclusion, the droughted saplings experienced lower photosynthesis rates, leaf water potential, and height growth than the watered saplings. Live oak appears to be less affected by drought than bur oak and Schumard oak, since it had similar leaf water potential but greater photosynthesis rates than the other two species. The three species differ in their carbon allocation patterns, and Schumard oak should be the most palatable of these three at day 60, since it had the greatest soluble sugar and lowest chemical defenses that could deter herbivory. These carbon allocation strategies might affect species survival and browse potential during the drought. Our results warrant further examination of physiological responses of three species to drought stress. We need to look more into the biological activities of that PPP, are there differences in the protein binding or methane reducing abilities of the PPP between the species? And we also need to look more into whole tree carbon allocation. For the live oak and the bur oak that had lower soluble sugar concentrations in their leaves than Shemart oak, is this because they are shifting more of these concentrations into their roots? We need to do more nutritional analyses on the leaf material that we collected, including analyses for nitrogen, additional carbon-based compounds like cellulose and lignin, and the digestibility of that material. This concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Any questions for Caitlin?
Yes. Well, it actually, I didn't conduct this study, but one of my colleagues looked at drought mortality across the state of Texas for that year, and it kind of varied by region. So in the regions like the Brazos Valley, where College Station is located, where there were a lot more post-oak trees and bur oak trees, a greater percentage of those died. And there are a lot of live oak trees there too, but not as many. So I don't really have a clear answer on that. It seemed like whichever tree was the most prevalent, of course, it had more that died. But as far as proportions, I'm not sure on the answer to that in the wild. Yes. It is, and that's a little confusing right now. I know I'm looking back at my soluble sugar data because we did have a few problems with the procedure, so I'm trying to make sure that everything is correct in that. But it could definitely happen since, at least in the live oak, a greater portion of its carbon should be going into some structural components of those leaves. They're a lot tougher. They have like a waxy coating on them. So there are some structural differences between all three of the species, but I do need to look more into what you're asking. Yes?
First of all, good job.
Thank you.
And second of all, why did you choose height and not diameter?
We did also measure diameter, I just didn't present that data. And it was actually pretty similar to the height results.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank Caitlin.